Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents In Good Faith, A History of the Vietnam War, Volume 1, 1945-65, by Sergio Miller, narrated by Paul Woodson. Chapter 1. The Serpent in Eden, 1945-60. Yoshijiro Umezu, chief of the Army General Staff, bowed very low. As well he might. 3 weeks previously, his country had twice been visited by a divine, destructive wind beyond the imagination of man. It blew in from the east and was released from the bellies of two silver aircraft flying high above the clouds, barely visible except to an attentive observer. Imperial Japan had vowed that the flower of her youth would stop the relentless advance of the American foe. Even on the verge of defeat, and faced with the imminent invasion of the home islands, the Imperial Japanese headquarters plotted insane, fantastic attacks, involving 6,500 kamikaze pilots and 5,000 suicide boats to halt the invaders. If it came to it, the generals concluded, 100 million Japanese should sacrifice their lives and charge the enemy with swords and bayonets. America gave her answer with the thunderclap of two atomic bombs. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer celebrated this novel way of annihilating entire populations by publishing a full-page advertisement of a bikini-clad model called Blanca Welter, Miss Anatomic Bomb, enjoying solar energy in an unexplosive moment, possibly the most vulgar documented response to the sudden, violent deaths of 150,000 human beings. Faced with annihilation, Emperor Hirohito made his jeweled voice capitulation speech to the nation, in fact a broadcast of a barely intelligible pre-recorded statement spoken in archaic Japanese. The previous day, Japan had been attacked by the biggest air raid of the Pacific War, involving over 1,000 aircraft, dropping conventional but no less destructive bombs. An earlier mass leaflet drop revealing the Emperor's secret decision to surrender had raised fears of civil unrest. This last psychological operation, coupled with the unstoppable Soviet advance through Manchuria, sealed the capitulation. Later detractors of the use of atomic weapons would ignore that, even in the very last hours of the war, Japan had to be pummeled into surrendering. The biggest shock of the atomic bomb was just how unshocked contemporaries were by its use. An 11-strong Japanese surrender delegation boarded the USS Missouri anchored in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945. They were led by the bespectacled foreign minister, Mamoru Shigemitsu, dressed incongruously in tails, white gloves, and a top hat. His left hand gripped a walking stick, a curiously emaciated symbol of state propping his missing leg. General Umezu, with downturned mouth, wore his customary peaked cap, three rows of medals, and riding boots with spurs. He looked, like the rest of the party, drawn and beaten. The surrender ceremony lasted less than half an hour, watched in silence by the entire ship's company and 300 journalists and photographers. MacArthur led the proceedings, but Fleet Admiral Nimitz made sure his name was also on the instrument of surrender, with the distinction that he was signing on behalf of the American nation, whereas MacArthur was signing in his capacity as Supreme Commander Allied Forces. Immediately behind the table on which the surrender documents would be signed, in single rank, were representatives of all the other countries with a stake in the brief and now vanquished Japanese Empire. The old colonial powers, Britain, France, and the Netherlands, as well as the awakened giants, China and the Soviet Union. Under the terms of the surrender, only 4 of the 8 nations ranged against Japan were legally counted as an Allied power. The remainder were parties to the surrender. The French representative found himself relegated to the second rank of powers, along with minnows like New Zealand. Following the short ceremony, there could be no doubt that the Emperor God had been brought back down to earth, and a new deity resided on the summit of Mount Fuji. America now found herself the de jure ruler of an Asian country. Her western border stretched across 5,000 miles of ocean, and now lying on the rim of the most populous continent in the world. 5 years later, and using a football metaphor, Secretary of State Dean Acheson would call this America's new defense line against a fresh enemy, communism. The line snaked all the way from northern Japan to the southernmost islands of the Philippines, bypassing Korea with unintended consequences and stopping short of the remaining European colonies of Southeast Asia, including French Indochina. Like great military eruptions of the past, it left the conquerors both bewildered and fascinated by their new possessions. This was the first important consequence of the war in the Pacific. For the next four decades, facing down the Soviet Union became the monolithic, unifying theme of American foreign policy, and its abiding metaphor was the race, in the development of new weapons, in space, in industrial output, and on sports tracks. Its constant fear was nuclear Armageddon, the better world that millions had fought for, if not a post-war Eden, then at least a place rid of the manifest evils of nationalist and totalitarian governments, had proved a child's fancy. A serpent had entered Eden, and its name was communism. The speed with which this happened forced a complete reversal of policy. If Moscow was going to play the discordant note to Washington's fiddle, then it was time to summon the marching bands. The hyperinflation of communism had profound consequences on American culture and self-image. Americans fought the Japanese to avenge a heinous wrong, trading war crime for war crime. But no American would have defined the essential character of Americanness as anti-Japanese. Despite the horrors perpetrated by the Nazi regime, the average GI held no strong feelings against the average German soldier. The lousy Kraut was a figure from the movies, and Patton's crude characterization of Germans was not shared by his Third Army, which just wanted to get the job done and come home. But communism, invariably spelled with a foreboding capital C, was absolutely different. The dreary ruminations of Karl Marx, read nowhere outside university campuses, became the words of the devil. Communism grew the horns of religious evil, not just political wrong or economic stupidity, threatening the very beacon on the hill the Puritans had first lit. The immediate post-war tension was and would remain in Europe. This was where vast armies still faced each other across Churchill's Iron Curtain. But a second front also opened in Asia, where the end of hostilities brought to the surface the many intractable problems exposed by the receding tide of Japanese imperialism. And it was here that America faced, in MacArthur's colorful phrase, a hard, monolithic block of China and Russia with no crevices in it. All the principal actors viewed the post-war settlement through the lens of their own ambitions and ideologies, and the outcome was always going to be more wars. For the French and Dutch, a return to the status quo ante was the logical resolution, and they were at first surprised and then resistant when they discovered that the newly liberated peoples of their former colonies no longer welcomed them. "Better to the hell than to be colonized again," ran the slogan on the sides of buses in Java, where British tanks and Thunderbolt aircraft were used to suppress rebellion against the war-exhausted Dutch. The British themselves were divided, but the more reasonable voices foresaw the end of empire and sought to manage Britain's disengagement from her far eastern colonies with equity and dignity. Australia and New Zealand had no imperial designs, although both administered a handful of colonial possessions, but eyed developments to the north with wariness. The long, indefensible coastline of Australia had been exposed by the Japanese. Could it happen again, with the threat of now communist-inspired liberation movements? From Moscow's onion-domed towers, Stalin saw the opportunity to gobble former disputed territories, tidy borders, and spread Soviet influence across the Far East. Nationalist China, exhausted by civil war, parleyed with the Red Army, but the relation was strained and would eventually break down. For America, the undisputed victor, the war had been fought to replace totalitarianism with democracy, and especially to champion self-determination, an ideal incompatible with the ambitions of the former colonial powers. Exhausted by this epic war, Washington first settled for Japan and then looked beyond to China, surrendering the complicated ethnic tangle of Southeast Asia to the Europeans. For the myriad native peoples who had witnessed the humiliation of European masters at the hands of an Asian army, the moment was ripe for revolt. With historical hindsight, the war against Japan proved to be only one of several wars that would ravage East Asia over the subsequent decades. The vacuum of retreating colonialism, swiftly sucking in superpower competition, was one agent, But nationalism and sectarianism, internal power struggles and land-grabbing, much of which masqueraded as liberation movements, also played important roles. This sparking of general, region-wide conflagration was the second great consequence of the war. For post-war generations of Western Europeans brought up to celebrate the Normandy landings, the sheer scale of America's Pacific struggle was as difficult to comprehend as it was remote. The armed forces of the United States conducted 78 amphibious landing operations over the course of the Pacific War, with the last launched at Sarangani Bay on July 12, 1945. By that summer, U.S. forces had occupied the Ryukyu and Rettō Island archipelagos just south of Japan and were within 200 miles of the mainland. It had been a supreme effort. For the average GI or Marine who lived through the experience, vengeance was all that counted, and the ticket home. It took almost 4 years to defeat Japan because of the geographical scale of the war and the necessity to fight on a second European front. But mostly the war was prolonged because Japan opposed Western military competence with ideological fanaticism. This feature of the war would be repeated in every subsequent conflict in Southeast Asia, where Western and Asian soldiers clashed. America suffered 106,207 war dead in the Pacific War. Her main ally, the British, suffered 52,000 fatalities, including 12,000 deaths in captivity. A further 86,838 British Indians added to this toll. By contrast, Japan suffered 2,133,915 military deaths from 1937 to 1945. As a very rough measure, American forces were perhaps inflicting 20 times as many fatalities on their enemy. The American way of war, at the very least, was a lethally effective way. The Pacific War not only proved an industrially murderous business, it was also an especially dehumanizing experience for the frontline soldier. A popular wartime poster urged U.S. servicemen to stay on the job until every murdering Jap is wiped out. This invocation was observed with a bloodlust that matched the abhorrent ideology of the Japanese Imperial forces. By the end of the war, soldiers returning from the Pacific theater had to make a customs declaration that they were not carrying body parts in their luggage. Never mind wiping out the Japanese, chop them to pieces and pickle them. When the remains of Japanese soldiers were repatriated from the Mariana Islands in the mid-1980s, it was discovered that 6 out of 10 were missing their heads. The same phenomenon of headless, as well as toothless or earless Japanese corpses was repeated across the Pacific Islands. Directives condemning and prohibiting the practice of collecting body parts as souvenirs were widely ignored. When Life magazine in May 1944 notoriously published the image of a young woman posing with the skull of a Japanese soldier sent to her by her naval officer boyfriend, there was pious public condemnation. But this censure missed the mood of a nation that viewed trophy skulls as legitimate spoils of war. "This is a good Jap, a dead one picked up on the New Guinea beach." Miss Nickerson, unfazed by the macabre gift, named the skull Tojo, after the Japanese general who ordered the attack on Pearl Harbor. The real Tojo kept his head long enough for it to be hung for war crimes in December 1948, but not his teeth. A 22-year-old Navy dentist called Jack Mallory rectified this by providing him with a set of dentures with the words "Remember Pearl Harbor" inscribed in Morse code as a prank. The War Department objected to the Life magazine cover, not because it was morally repellent, but because it endangered the lives of U.S. servicemen who might themselves be turned into Japanese body part trophies. The naval officer who sent the skull got away with a reprimand. As far as the Life editor was concerned, there was no wrongdoing. Did not the government's own propaganda describe the Japanese as rats, vermin, reptiles, apes, monkeys, bats, and insects? A Japanese skull was just one more animal trophy. This sense of racial superiority over the yellow Asiatic enemy, engendered in the Pacific and fortified in the Korean War, would multiply with frightful results in the Vietnam War. The tragic paradox of America as idealistic guarantor of liberty, but acting as out-of-control mobster, was the third great consequence of the Pacific War. Americans wanted to remember the war by the heroic, if staged, image of Marines hoisting the Stars and Stripes on Mount Suribachi, not by film of American soldiers shooting prone Japanese prisoners and hacking them with bayonets, footage that would only emerge 50 years after the conclusion of the Pacific War. The country least willing to accept the new political order was France. Not so much a nation as an idea that emerged from the Second World War in a mess, bankrupted but with undimmed imperial ambitions. Restoring la gloire française, French glory, quickened the pulse of every Frenchman, communists as much as Gaullists. Even as other European countries were preparing to unwind their colonial histories, France's soon-to-be Fourth Republic embarked on a suicidal project to retain her overseas possessions, and the first colony to challenge this vision was French Indochina. When traveler Pierre Barallon visited Indochina in 1893, for the benefit of readers of the popular weekly journal Le Tour du Monde, he wrote, "Le Cap Saint-Jacques est en vue, c'est la terre française." Cape Saint-Jacques is in view. This is French land. Half a century later, any Frenchman would have agreed with him. As early as September 1943, under the leadership of General Charles de Gaulle, a committee of national defense had been tasked with planning the recapture of Indochina. For administrative purposes, modern Vietnam was then a colony divided along the lines of its three historic regions. Northern Tonkin, Bac Bo, with Hanoi as capital, Central Annam, Trung Bo, administered by Hue, the imperial capital, and Cochin China, Nam Bo, served by cosmopolitan Saigon. The name Vietnam was a modern coinage. Vietnam's late imperial dynasties had governed a kingdom named Nam Viet, or South Viet. Chinese invaders reversed the name to Vietnam. The imperial court in Hue used the title Dai Nam, or Great South, up to the end of 1945. It was northern nationalists, led by the communists, who revived the title Vietnam, claiming it for their Democratic Republic of Vietnam. The French, of course, denied any such identity. When future Central Committee member Hoàng Quốc Việt worked his passage on a French ship, he proudly declared himself a Vietnamese. But his fellow French sailors shot back, "There was no such thing as Vietnam." Vietnamese history and identity had been defined by rivalry between these various ethnic blocs. Over a period of centuries, northern Vietnamese rulers had extended their rule over Annam and later Cochin China. This became the historic mission inherited by Vietnam's communist leaders. In their way stood the flotsam of a century of French colonialism that had four profound effects on Vietnamese society. In the political sphere, the imperial elite and Mandarin classes had been demoralized and eventually dismantled. Economically, traditional land ownership had given way to industrial estates and a rapacious rentier culture. It was said that the workers were fertilizer for the rubber trees because they died in droves and were buried in the plantations. This was an inevitable consequence of Paris designating the Indochinese possessions a colonie d'exploitation, colony of economic exploitation. The corollary to this deracination was social upheaval within an urban working class and a growing and educated middle class fed on a staple of French culture. Incongruously, Vietnamese were taught that their ancestors were Gauls. Lastly, the division between North and South was reinforced by policies that favored local French caciques, party bosses, over national unity. Roosevelt was absolutely right when he observed, "France has milked it, Vietnam, for 100 years. Ho Chi Minh would quip that the French built more prisons than schools. A legacy of Belle Époque public buildings barely compensated for these pernicious outcomes. This was Graham Greene's Vietnam of urine and injustices, taboo and illusion, dirty magazines, and restaurants with grill entrances to ward off grenade attacks." Life correspondent Theodore H. White, with his deep knowledge of Indochina, sketched it best. "The splendid French boulevards ran like causeways over a basin of hate." France's humiliation in Indochina began in June 1940, when Japan demanded the closure of the Haiphong-Yunnan Railway, used to supply nationalist forces in China. General Georges Catou, the governor-general and an officer steeped in the French colonial experience, had no option but to accede to the demand. For many months he had conducted a skillful diplomatic game with Tokyo in an effort to preserve the unity of the French colony, cognizant that his 90,000-strong Indochina army was a paper force. Just 14,500 were reliable Europeans. Trapped by the feebleness of the French position, Catou concocted the notion of a face-saving defensive alliance with Japan. His interlocutor, the Francophobe General Nishihara, an officer who had served as defense attaché in Paris, readily agreed to this proposal. 2 months later, on September 22nd, his Vichy government replacement, Vice Admiral Jean Decoux, endured greater humiliation. Faced with the ultimatum of an invasion, France agreed to the stationing of 6,000 Japanese troops on Vietnamese soil. A fiction of Japanese-French amity was preserved, but the reality was that the Japanese 5th Division had effectively ousted Decoux as the supreme authority in the country. To sustain this false narrative, a neutered French garrison was allowed to remain in territories now forcibly co-opted into Japan's Greater East Asian Prosperity Sphere. Decoux proved an energetic governor-general, as keen at hunting down the Bolshevist common enemy as building roads. But in making common cause with the Japanese, he had manifested a supreme hypocrisy that infected every subsequent French colonial government. A facade of greater Vietnamese participation in government masked an iron determination to resist the twin threats of a total Japanese takeover and Vietnamese nationalism. His government's policy, he explained at a secret meeting of Résidence Supérieure, the French ruling class, in Dalat in July 1942, was to play all sides against each other, maintaining as friendly relations with Japan as possible, while keeping lines of communication open with nationalist China and the Allies. The Japanese similarly played a double game, in public supporting the French authorities, but in private supporting subversive groups like the Hoa Hao Buddhists and the Cao Dai sect. From the Japanese perspective, Vietnam's sects were little more than peculiar minority movements, but they served the purpose of destabilizing French authority. The latter's full title was Dai Dao Tam Ki Pho Do, or the Great Religion of the Third Amnesty. Founded by the probably mad Ngô Văn Chu, the Cao Dai was an occult, syncretic movement borrowing from Christianity, Buddhism, and Taoism. Its saints included such diverse figures as Joan of Arc, the Chinese revolutionary Sun Yat-sen, and French author Victor Hugo. There were as many as 2 million Cao Daiists, mainly in Tai Ninh province northwest of Saigon, and they owed allegiance to a self-proclaimed pope, Pham Cong Thach, not the government. The Hoa Haos were formed by another religious fanatic, a Buddhist faith healer called Huang Phu So, who would be executed by the Viet Minh, turning the two movements into implacable enemies. There were perhaps 1.5 million Hoa Haos, mostly settled in the Mekong Delta. As the Pacific War expanded, tensions within Indochina multiplied. Gaullists and Vichy supporters schemed against each other, fomented by British intelligence. In the background, an austere wartime economy began to spiral out of control. The cost of a chicken jumped from just over half a piaster in 1939 to 18 piasters by 1945. The cost of a kilo of rice multiplied 20-fold. In May 1941, across the Chinese border in Guangxi province, Vietnamese exiles anticipating the end of French rule formed the Vietnam Doc Lap Dong Minh Hoi, the League for the Independence of Vietnam. This movement embraced a coalition of the veteran Indo-Chinese Communist Party, Vietnam Cong San Dang, ICP, the rival Vietnamese Nationalist Party, Vietnam Quoc Dan Dang, VNQDD, and two smaller parties, the New Vietnam Party and the Revolutionary Youth League. Nationalist Chinese attempts to manipulate the last three parties led to their loss of credibility and elevated the communists as the only genuine and independent Vietnamese nationalist cause. Internecine struggles then led to the dissolution of the ICP, leaving political leadership in the hands of a handful of armed men. Among the founding members of this resistance was the bone-thin, itinerant political activist later known to the world as Ho Chi Minh. His deputy was a former teacher and newspaperman with an interest in military history called Vo Nguyen Giap. The two had first met as students at the prestigious Lycée Quoc Hoc in Hue, the incubator of many of Vietnam's future leaders. Since those days, both had suffered hardship, imprisonment, and in the case of Giap, the loss of his wife, tortured in Hau Lo prison, where American pilots would later be incarcerated. Giap was entrusted with establishing the first fighting cadres of a rudimentary guerrilla force, the Viet Minh, meaning Light of the Land. Vo meant force, and Giap, shield, apt names for the future commander of Vietnam's communist forces. With an insurgent war churning around him, he was not short of inspiration. For the first 4 years, the Viet Minh achieved little militarily, partly because of the success of repressive measures introduced by De Ku. The Bureau de Statistique Militaire, the Army's intelligence service, proved especially effective in this regard. The first formal Viet Minh units were not raised until December 1944, and no significant actions were taken before March 1945. All the while, however, a covert, rural-based infrastructure was being painstakingly built, which would provide the foundation for future success. This seeming inactivity was also driven by Ho's painful experience of the failed November 22, 1940 uprising against the French, a half-cooked revolution, he concluded, was worse than no revolution at all. The Viet Minh were not isolated during this period of gestation. Nationalist China provided some material support and sanctuary. American support, which marked the beginning of direct American involvement in Vietnam and hence has a foundling quality about it, started with the Roosevelt government through the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. The first mention of Ho Chi Minh was made in OSS files dating to 1940. Secret arms shipments to the Viet Minh were made in 1942 and 1943, although there is some suggestion that the American suppliers were unclear who was actually receiving the weapons. The OSS was followed by bombers. In a foretaste of future raids, a sortie was conducted by 14th Air Force against Hanoi on April 12, 1943, that resulted in nearly 500 Vietnamese deaths, but only a handful of Japanese casualties. A raid on the docks of Saigon, on May 5, 1944, produced similar results. It was not until 1945 that B-29 and 3rd Carrier Fleet raids began to inflict worthwhile damage on the Japanese war effort in Indochina, but these attacks also witnessed high numbers of civilian casualties, including Europeans. Pitching French Indochina into the hands of Wild Bill Donovan's OSS, rather than subsuming it within MacArthur's military command, had other important consequences. Donovan was strongly opposed to the French regime in Indochina, viewing Vichy colonialism as little better than Japanese imperialism. Anti-French sentiment imbued the Indochinese mission from the beginning, and would continue to complicate Franco-American relations for the next decade. A Viet Minh eruption in northern Vietnam was finally precipitated by the unannounced Japanese attack on a weakened French garrison, codenamed Operation Mego Sakusen, on March 9, 1945. The coup was launched at precisely the same moment that Roosevelt was privately advising the French government there would be no Allied military action in French Indochina. De Gaulle had warned Roosevelt that the collapse of the Vichy government would encourage the Japanese government to at least subjugate the French administration in the Union of Indochina, and so it came to pass. By now, 5th Division had been replaced by 38th Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Yuitsu Tsuchihashi. The French were not entirely caught by surprise. Secret Japanese plans to seize control of French Indochina had been known to the French authorities for quite some time, thanks to American code-breaking. Ever suspicious of Washington's motives, some had discounted this valuable intelligence. Command of the colonial army in Hanoi fell under Lieutenant General Eugène Mordaunt. This old-fashioned general, with an exuberant walrus mustache, took the warnings seriously and prepared a contingency known as Plan A-835-3. This would see French forces withdrawing to the hills of the Red River Delta to await reinforcement, a forlorn hope. Operation Mego Sakusen unrolled irresistibly and ruthlessly. Despite spirited local French resistance, Plan A became a retreat. One of the more encouraging aspects of this otherwise desperate action was the manner in which the French and Viet Minh briefly found common cause against the Japanese enemy. But by May 2nd, the last soldiers of the demoralized French Indochina Army had crossed the Chinese border, leaving behind only scattered bands of partisans.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?